You still there? Newman asked. It came through faint and electronic, just a faraway squawk from the earpiece. Reacher put the phone back to his face. You sure about this? He asked. I'm sure, Newman said. 100% certain. It's totally definitive. Not one chance in a billion that I'm wrong. No doubt about it. You sure? Reacher asked again. Positive, Newman said. Totally, utterly positive. Reacher was silent. He just stared around the quiet, empty office. Light blue walls where the sun was coming through the pebbled glass of the window. Light gray where it wasn't. You don't sound very happy about it, Newman said.
I can't believe it, Reacher said.
Tell me again. So Newman told him again. I can't believe it, Reacher said. You're absolutely, totally sure about this? Newman repeated it all. Reacher stared at the desk blankly. Tell me again, he said. One more time, Nash. So Newman went through it all for the fourth time. There's absolutely no doubt about it, he added. Have you ever known me be wrong? Shit, Reacher said. Shit, you see what this means? You see what happened? You see what he did? I've got to go, Nash. I need to get back to St. Louis right now. I need to get into the archive again. You do indeed, don't you? Newman said. St. Louis would certainly be my first port of call. As a matter of considerable urgency, too. Thanks, Nash, Reacher said vaguely. He clicked the phone off and jammed it back in his pocket. Then he stood up and wandered slowly out of Costello's office suite to the stairs. He left the mahogany door standing wide open behind him. Tony came into the bathroom carrying the Savile Row suit on a wire hanger inside a dry cleaner's bag. The shirt was starched and folded in a paper wrapper jammed under his arm. He glanced at Marilyn and hung the suit on the shower rail and tossed the shirt into Chester's lap. He went into his pocket and came out with the tie. He pulled it out along its whole length, like a conjurer performing a trick with a concealed silk scarf. He tossed it after the shirt. Showtime, he said. Be ready in 10 minutes. He went back out and closed the door. Chester sat on the floor, cradling the package shirt in his arms. A tie was draped across his legs, where it had fallen. Marilyn leaned down and took the shirt from him, slipped her fingers flat under the edge of the paper and opened it up. She balled the paper and dropped it, shook out the shirt and undid the top two buttons. Nearly over, she said, like an incantation. He looked at her neutrally and stood up, took the shirt from her and pulled it on over his head. She stepped in front of him and snapped the collar up and fixed his tie. Thanks, he said. She helped him into the suit and came around in front of him and tweaked the lapels. Your hair, she said. He went to the mirror and saw the man he used to be in another life. He used his fingers and smoothed his hair into place. The bathroom door opened again, and Tony stepped inside. He was holding the Mont Blanc fountain pen. We'll lend this back to you so you can sign the transfer. Chester nodded and took the pen and slipped it into his jacket. And this. We need to keep up appearances, right? All these lawyers everywhere? It was the platinum Rolex. Chester took it from him and latched it on his wrist. Tony left the room and closed the door. Marilyn was at the mirror, styling her hair with her fingers. She put it behind her ears and pursed her lips together like she'd just used lipstick, although she hadn't. She had none to use. It was just instinct. She stepped away to the middle of the floor and smoothed her dress down over her thighs. You ready? She asked. Chester shrugged. For what? Are you? I'm ready, she said. Spencer Gutman Ricker and Talbot's driver was the husband of one of the firm's longest-serving secretaries. He had been a Deadwood clerk somewhere who hadn't survived his company's amalgamation with a lean and hungry competitor. 59 and unemployed with no skills and no prospects, he had sunk his payoff into a used Lincoln Town Car, and his wife had written a proposal showing it would be cheaper for the firm to contract him exclusively rather than keep a car service account. The partners had turned a blind eye to the accounting mistakes in the proposal and hired him anyway, looking at it somewhere halfway between pro bono and convenience. Thus, the guy was waiting in the garage with the motor running and the air on high when Jody came out of the elevator and walked over to him. He buzzed his window down and she bent to speak. "You know where we're going?" she asked. He nodded and tapped the clipboard lying on the front passenger seat. "I'm all set," he said. She got in the back. By nature, she was a democratic person who would have preferred to ride in front with him, but he insisted passengers take the rear seat. It made him feel more official. He was a sensitive old man, and he had caught the whiff of charity around his hiring. He felt that to act very properly would raise his perceived status. He wore a dark suit and a chauffeur's cap he had found in an outfitter's in Brooklyn. As soon as he saw in the mirror that Jody was settled, he moved away around the garage and up the ramp and outside into the daylight. The exit was at the back of the building, and it put him on Exchange Place. He made the left onto Broadway and worked across the lanes in time for the right into the Trinity Street dogleg. He followed it west and turned, coming up on the World Trade Center from the south. Traffic was slow past Trinity Church because two lanes were blocked by a police tow truck stopped alongside an NYPD cruiser parked at the curb. Cops were peering into the windows as if they were unsure about something. He eased past and accelerated, slowed and pulled in again alongside the plaza. His eyes were fixed at street level, and the giant towers loomed over him unseen. He sat with the motor running, silent and deferential. "I'll be waiting here," he said. Jody got out of the car and paused on the sidewalk. The plaza was wide and crowded. It was 2:05, and the lunch crowd was returning to work. She felt unsettled. She would be walking through a public space without Reacher watching over her for the first time since things went crazy. She glanced around and joined a knot of hurrying people and walked with them all the way to the South Tower. The address in the file was the 88th floor. She joined the line for the express elevator behind a medium-sized man in an ill-fitting black suit. He was carrying a cheap briefcase upholstered with brown plastic, stamped to make it look like crocodile skin. She squeezed into the elevator behind him. The car was full, and people were calling their floor numbers to the woman nearest the buttons. The guy in the bad suit asked for 88. Jody said nothing. The car stopped at most floors in its zone, and people jostled out. Progress was slow. It was dead on 2:00 when the car arrived on 88. Jody stepped out. The guy in the bad suit stepped out behind her. They were in a deserted corridor. Undistinguished closed doors led into office suites. Jody went one way and the guy in the suit went the other, both of them looking at the plates fixed next to the doors. They met up again in front of an oak slab marked Cayman Corporate Trust. There was a wired glass porthole set off center in it. Jody glanced through it, and the guy in the suit leaned past her and pulled it open. "We in the same meeting?" Jody asked, surprised. She followed him inside to a brass and oak reception area. There were office smells, hot chemicals from copying machines, stewed coffee somewhere. The guy in the suit turned back to her and nodded. "I guess we are," he said. She stuck out her hand as she walked. "I'm Jody Jacob," she said. "Spencer Gutman. For the creditor." The guy walked backward and juggled his plastic briefcase into his left hand and smiled and shook hands with her. "I'm David Forster," he said. "Forster and Abelstein." They were at the reception counter. She stopped and stared at him. "No, you're not," she said blankly. "I know David very well." The guy looked suddenly tense. The lobby went silent. She turned the other way and saw the guy she had last seen clinging to the door handle of her Bravada as Reacher hauled away from the collision on Broadway. He was sitting there, calmly, behind the counter, looking straight back at her. His left hand moved and touched a button. In the silence, she heard a click from the entrance door. Then his right hand moved. It went down empty and came back up with a gun the color of dull metal. It had a wide barrel like a tube and a metal hand grip. The barrel was more than a foot long.
The guy in the bad suit dropped his plastic case and jerked his hands in the air. Jody stared at the weapon and thought, "But that's a shotgun." The guy holding it moved his left hand again and hit another button. The door to the inner office opened. The man who had crashed the Suburban into them was standing there, framed in the doorway. He had another gun in his hand. Jody recognized the type from movies she'd seen. It was an automatic pistol. On the cinema screen, it fired loud bullets that smashed you 6 feet backward. The Suburban driver was holding it steady on a point to her left and the other guy's right, like he was ready to jerk his wrist either way. The guy with the shotgun came out from behind the counter and pushed past Jody, went up behind the guy with the bad suit and rammed the shotgun barrel into the small of his back. There was a hard sound, metal on metal, muffled by cloth. The guy with the shotgun put his hand up under the jacket and came out with a big chromium revolver. He held it up like an exhibit. "Unusual accessory for a lawyer," the man in the doorway said.
"He's not a lawyer," his partner said. "The woman says she knows David Forster very well, and this ain't him."
The man in the doorway nodded.
"My name is Tony," he said. "Come inside, both of you, please."
He stepped to one side and covered Jody with the automatic pistol, while his partner pushed the guy claiming to be Forster in through the open door. Then he beckoned with the gun, and Jody found herself walking towards him. He stepped close and pushed her through the door with a hand flat on her back. She stumbled once and regained her balance. Inside was a big office, spacious and square. Dim light from shaded windows. There was living room furniture arranged in front of a desk. Three identical sofas with lamp tables. A huge brass and glass coffee table filled the space between the sofas. There were two people sitting on the left-hand sofa, a man and a woman. The man wore an immaculate suit and tie. The woman wore a wrinkled silk party dress. The man looked up, blankly. The woman looked up in terror. There was a man at the desk. He was sitting in the gloom, in a leather chair. He was maybe 55 years old. Jody stared at him. His face was divided roughly in two, like an arbitrary decision, like a map of the western states. On the right was lined skin and thinning gray hair. On the left was scar tissue, pink and thick and shiny like an unfinished plastic model of a monster's head. The scars touched his eye, and the lid was a ball of pink tissue, like a mangled thumb. He was wearing a neat suit, which fell over broad shoulders and a wide chest. His left arm was laid comfortably on the desk. There was the cuff of a white shirt, snowy in the gloom, and a manicured hand, palm down, the fingers tapping an imperceptible rhythm on the desktop. His right arm was laid exactly symmetrical with his left. There was the same fine summer weight wool of the suit coat and the same snowy white shirt cuff, but they were collapsed and empty. There was no hand. Just a simple steel hook protruding at a shallow angle, resting on the wood. It was curved and polished like a miniature version of a sculpture from a public garden.
"Hobie," she said.
He nodded slowly, just once, and raised the hook like a greeting.
"Pleased to meet you, Mrs. Jacob. I'm sorry it took so long."
Then he smiled.
"And I'm sorry our acquaintance will be so brief."
He nodded again, this time to the man called Tony, who maneuvered her alongside the guy claiming to be Forster. They stood side by side, waiting.
"Where's your friend Jack Reacher?"
Hobie asked her. She shook her head.
"I don't know."
Hobie looked at her for a long moment.
"Okay," he said. "We'll get to Jack Reacher later. Now sit down."
He was pointing with the hook to the sofa opposite the staring couple. She stepped over and sat down, dazed.
"This is Mr. and Mrs. Stone," Hobie said to her. "Chester and Marilyn, to be informal. Chester ran a corporation called Stone Optical. He owes me more than $17 million. He's going to pay me in stock.
Jody glanced at the couple opposite. They both had panic in their eyes, like something had just gone terribly wrong. "Put your hands on the table," Hobie called. "All three of you. Lean forward and spread your fingers. Let me see 6 little starfish." Jody leaned forward and laid her palms on the low table. The couple opposite did the same thing automatically. "Lean forward more," Hobie called. They all slid their palms towards the center of the table until they were leaning at an angle. It put their weight on their hands and made them immobile. Hobie came out from behind the desk and stopped opposite the guy in the bad suit. "Apparently you're not David Forster," he said. The guy made no reply. "I would have guessed, you know," Hobie said, "in an instant. A suit like that? You've really got to be kidding. So who are you?" Again, the guy said nothing. Jody watched him with her head turned sideways. Tony raised his gun and pointed it at the guy's head. He used both hands and did something with the slide that made a menacing metallic sound in the silence. He tightened his finger on the trigger. Jody saw his knuckle turn white. "Curry," the guy said quickly. "William Curry. I'm a private detective working for Forster." Hobie nodded slowly. "Okay, Mr. Curry." He walked back behind the stones, stopped directly behind the woman. "I've been misled, Marilyn," he said. He balanced himself with his left hand on the back of the sofa and leaned all the way forward and snagged the tip of the hook into the neck of her dress. He pulled back against the strength of the fabric and hauled her slowly upright. Her palms slid off the glass and left damp shapes where they had rested. Her back touched the sofa, and he slipped the hook around in front of her and nudged her lightly under the chin like a hairdresser adjusting the position of her head before starting work.